Discworld! It's Discworld! Podcast! Analysis! Yeah! Woo!
So I'm Josh, I am your unseen academical, and I am back once again to not talk to you about Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, and instead continue my pyramids-inspired investigation of Egyptian fantasy and fantasy representations. Last episode, I talked about Western fantasy depictions of Egypt. This episode, I am going to be talking about actual Egyptian fantasy and science fiction literature, mostly the science fiction stuff, because that seems to be what's studied and what's available, as I'll get onto in the episode. Yeah, really pretty hard-pressed to find any definitively fantasy work from Egypt. But I will be talking this episode about the fantastic representation of Egypt in the works of P. Jelly Clark, and then, going into the history and origins of actual Egyptian fantasy, and particularly science fiction, looking into debates about its origins, its historical development, and providing some pretty close, probably too close examinations of influential and I think extremely interesting works by the Egyptian authors Mustafa Muhammad and Nayyad Sharif, which will give us a sketch of what Egyptian science fiction was like around the time leading up to when Pratchett wrote Pyramids. Then after that, I'll be jumping forward to the present day and the post-Arab Spring and Egyptian Revolution period, and looking at the current state of Egyptian science fiction and talking about some of the translations and adaptations that are readily available to English-speaking audiences outside of Egypt. So really not a whole lot to do with Pratchett in this one, though I think you will see as you go through the episode, and then I try and bring together all at the end. There are quite a lot of overlaps with the themes of a lot of, if not all, the Egyptian science fiction and fantasy works I'm going to be talking about in this episode, and the major themes of Pratchett's Pyramids, even if I think the authors are coming at them from pretty different angles and starting points. But I understand this won't be of interest to everyone, but it was clearly of interest to me. I mean, this has certainly been one of the more tangential suites of episodes I've done about one of Pratchett's novels. I found this extremely interesting and engaging to go through and discover all this stuff. And I'm putting it out there if anyone else is interested. I mean, essentially, over the next hour and a half or so, you're getting an absolute crash course in the history of Egyptian science fiction from someone who is just discovering this for themselves. Like, I do not claim to be in any way an expert on all of this. And my interpretation and understanding is, of course, as always, shaped and colored by the material that is available to me. And I think I do a pretty good job of giving the extremely zoomed out, broad overview of the tradition, with the exception of my closer analysis of the Muhammad and Sharif novels. I think maybe I get a bit too dense with some of that stuff, and in retrospect, I probably would have, pulled back a bit and just summarized and given the broad points rather than going into the detail that I do. But that's not what I did, and I'm not re-recording it. So if you do find you kind of hit a wall and slow down when you get to those points, I would encourage you to skip ahead to about the last half hour of the episode or so, where I pick up again with the modern day stuff, and we kind of zoom out a bit, and I think it's a little bit smoother and easy to follow. I mean, I think the stuff there is interesting, but it gets a bit bogged down quoting people that it's all translations of things, and I'm not really sure what I'm talking about. I'm talking about books that I haven't read that are in another language. So I don't know. I found editing it to be a bit dense, and I gotta tell you, I cut a huge amount out of this episode. So this is the streamlined Cliff's Notes version. This episode did take quite a bit longer to not put together and record, but to edit than I'd hoped it was going to. Like, this was all kind of ready to go last week before the long weekend, and then I got bogged down in the editing, but also in these middle sections, along with I think the content slowing down pretty significantly, there were a lot of problems with, I don't know, the way I'd recorded it or something. Something was going on with my microphone for those sections that was wreaking absolute havoc with the compression and other stuff that I applied to this, so it might sound a bit weird and uneven in places. I did my best. It took a long time and a lot of effort, but again, that does smooth out and become more consistent and clear in that back half. So if you're struggling in the middle of this, just jump forward to the end. I think that's where some of the more interesting stuff is anyway. But speaking of bogging things down, I think I've talked enough at this point, so I will shut up and let you guys get on with it. So I want to start by going back to something Butler said in his Pocket Essential review of Pyramids, which I realize I've based a lot of this analysis for this book on. But in that review, Butler observes that, of course, most of us only know Egypt through versions of the mummy and holiday programs, so there's no need for any in-depth research. The writer can play on the reader's knowledge of Egypt as much as parodying fantasy, and that perhaps a useful comparison can be made with the Carry On series of films, such as Carry On Cleo, which I talked about in the last episode, noting that none of these films are dependent on a detailed knowledge of Cleopatra or Egyptian history, but rather treat it as a specialized setting to act as a backdrop to a rather limited repertoire of routines, which I think is itself a bit of a swipe at quality of the Carry On films. But I do think it also speaks to just the rather limited repertoire of Egyptian-themed fantasy itself. Another similarly parodic work such as the Carry On series of films seems to be this really rich and obvious prevalent setting for fantasy stories and things. But in having done a survey of and really gone looking for, you know, notable works of Egyptian-themed fantasy, you're limited to about three or four lanes, right? There's mummy and curse stories, which I did a whole episode on last time, but as you will have heard from that, even that is itself a very narrow repertoire of variations on that theme that all seem to be remakes of themselves. Then you have the Cleopatra stories, and then there are stories that bring in elements of the biblical Exodus and the Pharaoh and the 10 plagues and things there. And I think this speaks to the pastiche nature of fiction and parody that, you know, often in something like the Carry On films or Pyramids or whatever, it doesn't matter that we're parodying ancient mummies and Cleopatra and Exodus often all at once, even though they happened at various different stages of history, separated by thousands of years of cultural development and things. It's all sort of compressed into this one sort of shared version of Egypt that isn't really allowed to stray too far from these expectations and limitations, right? This kind of, on a meta level, speaks to this idea of polders and boundaries, that these are the restrictions that we've drawn around Egyptian fantasy, but not necessarily deliberately. I don't think anyone's sitting down and saying, thou shalt only talk about Cleopatra, right? But they're just the things that through the culture have come to be expected and therefore incorporated into all versions of Egypt and things. And going back to the polder idea of that sort of the fantasy polders separating times from history and development, right? Perhaps the reason these Egyptian stories aren't as widespread or varying as something like vampire fiction or the fairy tales that have had these huge revisions and reinterpretations and things is that there is such a rigid boundary of expectations that, you know, Western writers at least seem willing to explore. So having gone looking specifically for Egyptian-themed fantasy, I'm again kind of shocked as much as it is this kind of big prevalent setting, there aren't really that many notable, significant, influential works of Egyptian fantasy. Like, this does seem to be something that mainly becomes prevalent through the film tradition and the mummy stuff that I talked about last episode. I mean, there's a whole bunch of more historical fiction, right, rather than fantasy or science fiction stuff, so I've tended to ignore that. I'm putting it to the side because I want to focus on genre stuff, and there does seem to be quite a bit more recently, actually, of, like, more young adult and young reader angled, you know, fantasy adventure stories that draw on Egyptian mythology and things. I've ignored them because they're kind of for younger readers, and therefore I'm assuming insubstantial. They might be quite interesting and significant, but it's not my area of interest or expertise. So excluding those two sets, if we're looking for like adult genre fantasy, this is outside of all the mummy stuff, which draws more from, I guess, the horror and adventure story traditions. But as far as modern fantasy goes, there are only really two books that seem to come up consistently in my searches. The first, the most readily and often recommended one, is Tim Powers' novel The Anubis Gates from 1983, which is ostensibly about an ancient Egyptian wizard or necromancer who is opening interdimensional time portals and summoning ancient demons and things as a means of getting revenge against England and Europe for the wrongs of colonization, which sounds like a great premise, and that is what the prologue of the story is about. What this novel, which is very long and rather long-winded, I don't think the writing in it is particularly good, but what the story ends up actually being about is going back in time to 19th century London and hanging out with Lord Byron and Samuel Taylor Coleridge and things.
So yeah, it ends up being a rather Anglo-centric story. And there is a section at the end where they go back to Egypt, but it's pretty insignificant to the story as a whole. It's more a device rather than the means or the source of the action, which really is focused on the Byron Coleridge stuff, which is pretty disappointing given the premise and because Powers already has like a bunch of other novels about going back in time and banging Mary Shelley and things. Other science fiction and fantasy writers from the same period have kind of exhausted that theme, I think. So that one was a bit of a dud. The other one you get, which is a bit of a more specialized recommendation, but is Roger Zelazny's Creatures of Life and Darkness from 1969, so quite a bit earlier there. And this is a kind of semi-sequel to Zelazny's 1967 novel, Lord of Light, which is often regarded, I think rightly so, as one of the best fantasy or science fiction books ever written. But if you're unfamiliar, that story is kind of a retelling of Hindu religions and mythology based on the premise of people having uploaded their consciousness into this, you know, post-human computer intelligence that then recreates societies and puts their brains into avatars of these mythological people, and then they replay these myths and things. And that's what we get here with Creatures of Life and Darkness as well, except this time it is a retelling of Egyptian mythology based on the same premise. It's a lot shorter, it's not as complex and developed, and knowing Egyptian mythology a bit better than I do Hindu stuff, I found the, I guess, twist or resolution of this story pretty obvious from the beginning. Like, if you know even kind of cursorily about Egyptian mythology, you know who the major players are, you know what the big stories are, so it was kind of obvious where everything was going, and by the time it got to the end of the story, it did seem like it was only the first half of the book, like, seemed like things have kind of picked up and we're going somewhere and we're about to get the departure from the religion, and then it just kind of ends. Like, it kind of seems a little bit unfinished, like he wrote half a book and he's like, I'm tired of this. So that one, better, interesting, but not really doing anything other than playing around in the toy box of mythology. Another one I've seen come up a few times is a 2003 novel called Joust by Mercedes Lackey, who I think I talked about. She was the author of one of the feminist fairy tale revisions that I talked about in relation to Witches Abroad. I think this is part of a series about jousting dragon riders. I don't know. It looks like pretty trashy stuff. I know you're not meant to judge books by their cover, but I know what the cover of books I like look like. And yeah, this has a very specific kind of dragon lance, trashy romance fantasy kind of vibe to it. So I don't know, maybe I'll revisit it when I get into Dragons for Guards, but I chose to avoid that one. But yeah, there's two, and really it is only the Powers Anubis Gate one that constantly gets brought up when looking for Egyptian fantasy. That's kind of all that's out there that seems to be of significant note or influence. And yeah, I'm a bit surprised that we haven't got more of a revival or response revision of this kind of colonialist Egyptian stuff like we've seen with the feminist fairy tale revisions of the 1980s. But it does seem really hard outside of the early 20th century and late 19th century mummy, you know, archaeological adventure tradition to find anything Egyptian themed in this Egyptian fantasy tradition, let alone fantasy or science fiction by Egyptian writers. Like, everyone I've been talking about so far, you know, is a British or American writer. And when I was first thinking of this and what seems to stand in for this sort of post-colonial revisionist response trend that I was expecting to find is that one of the new fantasy authors to gain a bit of prominence and notoriety within recent fantasy is P. Jelly Clark, who I said I'd talk about a bit more this episode. Yes, P. Jelly Clark, I think, first rose to prominence with his 2016 novella, A Dead Djinn in Cairo, and then his 2022 novel, A Master of Djinn, which won both the Nebula and Locus Awards for the best fantasy novel of their respective years. And as you might have gathered from the titles of these works, right, this is Egyptian-themed fantasy set in Cairo, so I think that is something else significant, right, rather than Egyptian artifacts or mummies or things being brought over into England or America. There's a story set in Egypt. They're kind of an alternate fantasy history where, you know, all the mythology and djinn stuff, so djinn being a demon genie in African and Arabic mythologies and things and folklore. These are sort of mystery fantasy stories set in, yeah, an alternate fantastic Egypt, which is all very interesting. I mean, the main drawback is I don't think these books are very good. You may have noticed that Master of Jin ended up on my list of the worst books that I read. I think it was last year, but yeah, I was pretty disappointed in that one. I don't think I even finished it, and I think it did win all these awards, but I have read quite a few reviews out there saying that the writing and characterization and plotting of it leave a lot to be desired, which was my experience. But yeah, while Clark has sort of staked his claim and reputation to this Egyptian revisionist fantasy, and like that is specifically kind of implied by his name, P. Jelly Clark, and this is spelt like Jelly Baby, right? D-J-E-L-I, which is a name for traditional West African storytellers and poets and things who keep their oral traditions and history. I think I talked a bit about that in the first Pyramids episode about the name Jelly Baby and its possible relation there. I mean, again, with the compressing and pastiching, jelly seems to be a specific Western African concept or position, so it's not a particularly Egyptian or Arabic one, but I'm sure there's probably some crossover, and the pen name P. Jelly Clark is certainly invoking this sort of African folklore historian position, except that Clark, whose real name is Dexter Gabriel, he himself is not Egyptian, right? He is an American author, and his parents are from Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean, so he's more directly of South American or West Indian descent. You know, I don't know what his... I've tried to find some interviews and things about the reason for his name and the reason for the Egyptian setting. I didn't find anything particularly enlightening, and I'm not saying that because he is not of Egyptian heritage or anything that he shouldn't be writing about these sort of things. Not the point I'm trying to make. But even when it's being, you know, deliberately signaled, he is deliberately engaging with and exploring these aspects. But yes, I think even when there's this concerted effort, we're still a bit of remove from a specifically Egyptian or even African fantasy or science fiction tradition itself. I mean, one notable author who is from Africa and has written a successful series of Egyptian historical fiction is Wilbur Smith, who is a British-based novelist, but who was born in northern Rhodesia, what is now known as Zambia. So not actually Egypt itself, but continentally African, even though Egypt, you know, culturally these days has more to do with the Arabic and Middle Eastern cultures and things. But yeah, he has a rather successful series of historical novels, the Ancient Egypt series, beginning with 1993's River God, which is about the Pharaoh Memnon. These seem interesting and maybe semi-fantastical, but yeah, not really my style of story, so I haven't delved into them at all. But the point I'm trying to make here is that having gone looking for, you know, Egyptians writing about Egypt in Egypt fantasy, you know, at least in an accessible way to a, you know, Western English-speaking reader, I found next to nothing, right? You know, Smith and Clark are as close as we're getting, and neither of them are Egyptian. There's still a few steps of remove in terms of cultural and geographical connections there as well. So, you know, if you're just scraping the surface and looking around at the popular fiction tradition, I think you're going to be hard-pressed to find authentic Egyptian fantasy. Now, while Egyptian and Arabic fantasy itself is hard to come by, there does seem to be a bit of a boom in more recent scholarship in the area, more specifically in relation to science fiction rather than fantasy. But yeah, there is a 2018 book called Arabic Science Fiction by a guy named Ian Campbell, which I'll be talking about a bit more in depth later on. But as its title suggests, that is more focused on the science fiction tradition. But in there, he does go into a bit of the history of Egyptian fantasy. And in this case, I'm talking about written by and for Egyptians rather than about Egyptians. And in doing this, he relies rather heavily on the Italian-based, but I think Tunisian or Syrian-born or at least backgrounded scholar, Ada Barbaro, particularly her 2013 book, La Fantastazinia Nella Letterata Araba, or Science Fiction in Arabic Literature, which is unfortunately unavailable in English, which is why I've given the Italian title there. I'm sure that book would be very useful, so anything I'm saying about her work, you know, I'm getting secondhand through Campbell. But yes, by his summary, Barbaro argues that modern Arabic science fiction derives from four genres of classical Arabic literature, being fantastic philosophical voyages, adventure voyages, such as those from The Thousand and One Nights, the Arabic utopian tradition, and an Arabic genre called mirabilia, or wonder stories, which they summarize as being stories about real or imaginary places, events, or things which are specifically constructed to challenge our human understanding, which is a pretty broad genre definition there. From what I gather, you know, these were stories being written by sailors or travelers and things who would go to, you know, other countries, other places, and bring back stories of the things they had there, but then they would embellish them and blur the lines with the fantastic through exaggeration. So you'd be like, whoa, I went over there and they had this thing and you'll never believe, and it was like dragon or some shit. So sort of fantastic travel narratives based on exaggerated real world expositions that are meant to play up the difference and also just extended possibilities of other places and things. You know, I'm not going to go much more into that because I'm not particularly familiar with it other than some of the examples Campbell and Barbara described. But while it sounds very interesting, I don't think it's particularly relevant. This is just to say that it is part of the basis for Arabic fantasy, which, yeah, seems to share a similar background as Anglo-American and European science fiction in, you know, being a blend of these fantastic voyage stories and more extrapolative utopias and things like that. Of course, the big one there that I think is the dominant influence and is certainly bled over into Western culture is the 1001 Nights, along with its English and romantic interpretations, which again I will talk a lot more about when we get to sorcery, so I'm sort of saving myself for that one. But yeah, while both Barbara and Campbell gesture to this, I guess, kind of rich history of fantastic, if not quite what we would think of as modern fantasy narratives, I can't find any examples of or even indication that it exists of an actual, you know, modern Egyptian fantasy tradition in the way we would think of it in terms of like high fantasy and things like that. And, you know, I guess I would kind of expect it to be more rooted in the Arabian Nights style than anything, you know, particularly Tolkien-esque. But yeah, for all its prevalence within 19th century adventure stories and the horror tradition, and even just as a setting in broader fantasy and things like that, actual Egyptian fantasy itself, I can find no record of its existence beyond these, you know, pre-19th century examples. I'm sure it exists. I'm sure it's just I'm over here speaking English in Australia and I don't know what I'm talking about or where to find it. But so I don't know what's going on there. I assume it exists, just I don't know where to find out about it. But it's certainly not readily available or apparent to Western English-speaking readers and academics like myself. But yeah, as I mentioned before, a lot more work and focus has been done into the Egyptian science fiction tradition. So yeah, while, you know, I have talked about how Pratchett perhaps brings in more of a science fictional mode to his writing than many other fantasy authors, but yes, he is still nominally a fantasy writer. Discworld is a fantasy world. They are fantasy books. But yeah, just due to a lack of access and evidence of Egyptian fantasy, I am, like these academics now, going to focus on the science fiction tradition because it's all I have to work with. But also, yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in there that does end up tying in rather heavily to the themes that Pratchett put forward in Pyramids. So as the Israeli academic Reuven Sneer notes in his 2017 book, Modern Arabic Literature, research into the development of science fiction in Arabic literature is essentially limited to a few studies by Arab scholars who he says do not belong to the canonical center of the literary system, and whose works are mainly confined to the description of original Arabic works without investigating the background issues of how this genre developed through the interference from Western culture, right? Which is his big argument that modern Egyptian and Arabic science fiction is rooted in and is a response to Western science fiction works rather than a distinctly Arabic or Egyptian tradition, which I'll get into a bit more detail about in a second. But I want to point out that Sneer also notes how science fiction is not always clearly defined in these studies, and that scholars are often confusing it with fantasy. So much the same as, you know, Western science fiction and fantasy scholarship as well, but also when I'm talking about a science fiction tradition here, and the works I'll be talking about are, you know, more obviously science fictional and fantastic, as with the Western tradition, there is a lot of overlapping and, you know, somewhat symbiotic and cognate existence of these true traditions. But Sneer argues that Arabic science fiction began to develop properly in the 1950s and 60s in response to increased interest in space and technology prompted by the space race, whereas previous demand for science fiction stories had been filled by translations of English novels. And this position is supported by pretty much all the Arabic science fiction scholars that I consulted for this, particularly Barbara Michalik Pikaluska and Sebastian Gadomsky. I'm very sorry about how I've said their names, but they write in their 2022 article on the beginnings of Egyptian science fiction literature that most Arab scholars similarly consider Arabic science fiction to have emerged as a borrowing from the Western tradition, while Issam al-Bahir writes in their 1999 book on science fiction in Tawfiq al-Hakim's theatre that Arabic science fiction writers necessarily turned to the Western heritage of this literary genre. So the idea is that, you know, there were popular works of early science fiction by Wells and people like that that were translated into Arabic before the 1950s, and then with the space race and things, the people that had been reading these books started to write their own works in the vein of the English and other Western texts that they had been reading. Now, conversely, Pierre Keisha, who was born in Egypt and studied at the American University in Cairo before doing his doctorate at Edinburgh University in the UK and then later working in the US, he points out in his 1990 Overview of Modern Arabic Literature, a program of modernity that has been promoted by Arab intellectuals for the better part of 100 years, which he says can be broadly understood as the realization of the values of Western civilization, powerfully centered together by Arab nationalism. Now, Keisha hereby argues that modern Arabic literature is virtually all about Arabs, noting a paucity, a scarcity, of literature of mere estrangement, which is to say, fantasy and science fiction, arguing that no Arab writer has made a name for themselves as a writer of detective, spy, gothic, or science fiction novels, or of sport and adventure stories, despite the popularity in the Arab world of Western detective stories, such as those about Sherlock Holmes and the French detective Arsène Lupin. He says, nor has any Arab novelist established themselves mainly as a humorous writer, stating that there is no P.G. Wodehouse in the Arab world. So no one really around to inspire the type of fiction and philosophy that Pratchett expresses in his fiction, perhaps. Although I don't know how deeply Keisha really considers examples of genre fiction in his survey. I mean, his only actual mention of fantasy is in briefly dismissing the Arabian Nights as literary fantasy, claiming they are more highly valued in the West than in their homelands, and have only lately obtained a measure of recognition from the Arab literary establishment, which is at least in part because of the status they have achieved abroad. So a bit of a simulacra thing going on there. I mean, again, I will get into Western history with an interpretation of the Arabian Nights when I get to sorcery. Remember, while Keisha presents a rather authoritative view on the subject, Sneer argues that he merely illustrates the traditionally narrow scholarly conception of contemporary Arabic literature during the past few decades on the part of Western critics and scholars, and goes on to provide various examples of Arab writers who have made their name as writers of detective stories, science fiction, and humor genres. Now, these examples are mostly in Arabic, nor are descriptions or summaries of them even really readily available, so I can't really follow them up, but they do seem like rather minor exceptions that aren't really comparable to more canonical or canonically recognized, but certainly influential and ongoing Western traditions, right? I don't think there is an equivalent of a P.G. Wodehouse or an H.G. Wells or someone like that, and it does seem like, you know, the examples that Sneer gives continue to be extremely niche, or if there is a strong, you know, genre tradition linking them together, they are certainly overlooked both abroad and within the wider academy. Nevertheless, Sneer himself winds up arguing that Islamist authors have actually taken to science fiction as a means to help them spread Islamic concepts, both because of the impact of the genre on popular readerships, and also because of its inherently utopian aspect, which I've talked about on previous podcasts, about how science fiction and to an extent fantasy, you know, necessarily forces the reader to consider ways that their world could be different, and in the case of science fiction, at least try and attempt to see how we might bring about such estrangements and reorganizations. And as evidence of this utopian aspect, Sneer cites an examination of utopian writing by Egyptian political prisoners and oppressed Turkish religions, which I thought was pretty interesting, but then I did follow up with that article, and it does seem to be just kind of like a one-off or two-off broad example of like one person who was doing this. It's not necessarily a broader tendency or tradition that you could hang any particular influence on, but still an example of utopian writing as, you know, political, not praxis, then assertion, promotion, I guess, within the Arabic and Egyptian world. In my research, I also came across a book, I guess the rather eclectically named Jörg Matthias Dietermann. I'm not sure where he's from. His online profile say that he did his PhD in London and now teaches as an assistant professor of history at the Virginia Commonwealth University in Qatar. There's quite an eclectic cultural background there. But yeah, he put out a book in 2021 on Islam, science fiction, and extraterrestrial life, which I'm now going to point to anytime anyone says that my book on, you know, vegetarianism and science fiction and environmental and animal ethics and things is too niche. I point to the one about Islamic science fiction and extraterrestrial life. Like, yeah, this is an examination of Arab science fiction, but with a particular focus on the depiction and interpretation of aliens and things. I didn't find much in there that was really pertinent to my investigation here, although Diederman does point out the prominence of Arab depictions in early Western cinema as well, you know, around the turn of the 20th century in conjunction with all this archaeological adventure story stuff that I talked about in the previous episode. In particular, he points out that the French director, Georges Méliès, who did A Trip to the Moon, which is the black and white silent film with the moon with the face in it that's got the rocket in its eye, pretty popular common image that I believe is still on the homepage of the Science Fiction Studies Journal website, if you go there, and is a very loose adaptation of Jules Verne's 1865 novel From the Earth to the Moon, which is one of the very few Jules Verne books worth reading. It's a send-up of American gun culture, which is perhaps more relevant today than when it was written over a century and a half ago. And Diederman also points out that, you know, Verne himself often produced Orientalist works, including Around the World in 80 Days and I guess the less well-known Begum's Fortune. But that was in 1902. A few years later, in 1905, Méliès also released a film titled The Palace of the Arabian Nights. That was another popular feature of early Western cinema, among which adaptations of the 1001 Nights and its stories were pretty common. And I think he goes on to talk a bit about the establishment of the early film industry in Cairo and things to meet this demand for sort of Orientalist cinema. Not really relevant here. I'm mostly focusing on books and things, but, you know, if you want more information about that, you can go and check out that book. Going back to the literary tradition, though, Sneer argues that following the influence of the Western tradition and translation, original Arabic works of science fiction have, he says, existed at least since the 1970s and have mainly taken the form of short stories since then, which is another reason why maybe, you know, I'm primarily looking for novels and things, which is what dominates, I guess, the modern Anglo-American science fiction tradition. You know, had the pulp magazines and stuff in the early part of the 20th century, and short stories are, of course, still around. But even then, you know, the pulp magazines often contain serialized novels and reprints of earlier 19th century novels and things. So as much as the short pulp story was instrumental in popularizing the form, I do think the novel has always been the dominant form of science fiction and fantasy, especially when you compare that at the same time we were getting these pulp stories, you were also getting a lot of the early dystopian novels and fantasy stuff in the English tradition from, you know, Lord Dunsany and William Morris and things like that. So there's a bit of a split between the English and the American traditions there. However, in their 2002 article on the beginnings of Egyptian science fiction literature, Mikolak Pikolska and Gadamonsky, who perhaps I'm going to refer to as MPNG, which is how I have them in my notes. I think that might just be better for everyone. But they claim that the earliest literary work of Egyptian literature to which Arab critics refer when considering the origins of science fiction is actually Muhammad al-Mahawali's 1906 serial A Period of Time, or What Issa bin Hissim Told Us, wherein the eponymous protagonist wanders the streets of Cairo with a resurrected 19th century war minister who points out things and comments about society. So quite similar to Loudon's Mummy story that I talked about last episode. Now, this assertion of science fiction's origins in this serial stems from a 1994 book on science fiction literature of the 20th century by Muhammad Qasim, which I don't have access to. This is just secondhand through MPNG. But as they know, Qasim's opinion here is rather controversial, since al-Mahawali's story is in keeping with the pre-existing Makwama genre, which were satirical stories, usually containing some kind of fantastic or fairy tale elements, but which MPNG say are far from contemporary science fiction literature. Although, you know, I might push back on that a bit, having not read or having access to this story, but from its description, and say, well, not if we're counting things like Loudon's Mummy as part of the modern science fictional tradition. Just going off that description, they sound quite similar, though again, I don't know if Loudon's example would be taken that seriously if it weren't for the pre-existence and connection to Shelley's Frankenstein, which itself is taken as the starting point of the modern Anglo-American science fiction tradition. You know, that's going all the way back to 1818, so, you know, almost 100 years before even the earliest contentious examples of Arabic and Egyptian science fiction are being thrown around. Another early example asserted by Hamada Hazar and Muhammad Ahmed and Muhammad Ahmed, Ahmed Mustafa, who perhaps has the most Arabic name possible, but they trace the tradition to the 1926, but they trace the modern Arabic science fiction tradition to the 1926 story, Introduction to Egyptian Blessedness by the journalist and political theorist Salama Musa, which envisions a Rip Van Winkle-like man who suffers brain paralysis and is revived in a seemingly utopian future Egypt in the year 3105. I mean, again, to me, this kind of sounds like more traditional utopianism, but it does sound like there's maybe some more science fictional elements with the brain paralysis stuff that they get in there that might align this with something like H.G. Wells's When the Sleeper Wakes, which was, you know, around the same time or a decade or so before. But more notably, the author, Salama Musa, was apparently an avowed secularist who was instrumental in introducing the writings of Charles Darwin, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Sigmund Freud to utopian readers. So tying in the origins of an arguable origin of Arabic and Egyptian science fiction with the influence of more secular and scientifically focused works, more secular works of, you know, Western science and philosophy there. And lastly, as far as potential origins go, MPNG also point out Tawfiq el-Hakim's 1950 play, If the Young Men Had Known, which is about a man who invents an anti-aging serum, and also the 1940s radio dramas of Yusuf Is al-Din, which they describe as being mostly kind of mildly fantastic stories, mostly for children, but they say that 1950s A Man from the Past, which is about what MPNG call the hibernation of a man who returns to his family after being in a coma of 50 years, is more science fictional, and as we'll see, and why I'm sort of mentioning all these early examples in the first place, as you might have picked up on, there's a thread here about, you know, people hibernating or being frozen and waking up in the future to experience a more utopian Egypt. Yeah, we might see this theme running through some more modern examples of Egyptian science fiction when I get to them. But yes, it does seem that even accepting some of these, you know, contentious early examples, that the modern Egyptian tradition is coming to fruition somewhere in the first half of the 20th century. But as far as the genre's development from these origins, we have the founder of the Egyptian Society for Science Fiction, Hossam Abdu al-Hamid Elzembly, who I'll talk about in more detail a bit later on, but in his and Emad al-Din Aisha's 2022 collection on Arab and Muslim science fiction, he breaks down the development of Egyptian science fiction into four distinct stages. So if we count this early 20th century stuff as sort of proto-science fictional stuff, he says, we first get Egyptian science fiction proper in the 1950s and 60s with what he calls the exploring wave, which, as I mentioned earlier, is largely inspired by the space race, and he says is dominated by major literary figures who had earlier made their names in theatre, literary criticism, and philosophy, and whose works often blurring the lines between fantasy and science fiction and other more established modes of literature as well. We then have what he calls the more defined founding wave of the 1970s and 80s, which saw a lot more authors, including Nihad Sharif, who, again, I'll talk about a bit in a bit more detail later on, but who Elzembly calls the first full-time science fiction writer in Egypt and the wider Arab world. But again, Elzembly says that most of these authors were already established literary figures from other genres. We then have the third wave, the spreading wave, which he says takes place from the 1990s through to 2011, when we had the Arab Spring Revolution. And he says, as far as science fiction goes, this was an arid period with only a handful of prominent authors, notably Nabil Farouk and Ahmed Khalid Tawfiq, who were prolific authors of popular pulp stories in the genres of science fiction, action adventure, spy fiction, horror, and the paranormal. And then fourth and finally, we have the what Elzembly calls, I think rather self-servingly, as we'll get on to, the authenticity wave, which he says is everything from 2011 on. I will talk about what that means and its implications later, but I don't know if you can directly map this on to the development of Western Anglo-American science fiction, but there does seem to be a similar, albeit rather compressed, trajectory of the development here, coming out of the primarily utopian tradition with a bit of, you know, fantasy and fairy tale thrown in there, and going through this kind of high literary utopia dystopia focused period, as with late 19th and early 20th century English science fiction, and then in the 90s with the arid spreading wave, you get a dominance of pulp stories that are crossing over with more action-based based genres like, you know, spy stories and horror and action adventure and things like that. Though at the same time, this seems to be going in parallel with some of the like 50s golden age space race stuff. You know, so I don't expect to map it one to one or anything like that. If you're trying to wrap your head around it by dividing it up into distinct periodic categories, as Elsenbury has done, and which is always a, you know, fraught exercise because there's always going to be examples, that is the timeline and periodization that he provides to bring us up to date. You know, when Pratchett would have been writing Pyramids at the end of the more utopian and literary focused founding wave of the 70s and 80s, through the popular pulp wave of the 1990s and early 2000s, and through to the authenticity wave of the modern era. I'll get to what that means later on. But first, I want to slow down, take a closer look at some of the more revered and influential works of these earlier, more, I guess, literary focused periods that would have existed before Pratchett was writing Pyramids. Yes, so as I mentioned earlier, perhaps the most readily available and thorough analysis of Egyptian science fiction is the American academic Ian Campbell's 2018 book Arabic Science Fiction, which, yeah, largely follows Barbaro's definition and schematics of the Arabic fantasy and science fiction traditions. Nevertheless, as a review of the book published by the Science Fiction Research Association, of which Campbell is a member, they, or rather the reviewer, which is a guy named Stephen Herms, points out Campbell's sustained emphasis on our boy Darko Suvin, despite Campbell's professed interest in how Arabic science fiction might differ from or even critique the English-speaking tradition. So yes, further justification and reassurance that the huge side tangent I did into dissecting Suvin's theories about fantasy and utopia and things was warranted and indeed rather crucial for our ongoing examination of Pratchett and related literature. And indeed, Campbell's main argument in the book builds off Suvin's theories. Right, if we remember, Darko Suvin defines science fiction as the literature of cognitive estrangement, something that's estranged, removed from reality, and then cognitively connected back to it. And Campbell says that Arabic science fiction is instead defined by a mode of what he calls double estrangement, whereby fantastically estranged stories are also almost invariably political allegories by which Arab writers in all genres have learned to conceal their social critiques in order to provide plausible deniability in the face of scrutiny by the oppressive regime under which they're written. And while I think this tendency is certainly apparent in Egyptian science fiction, as I'll get onto with some of the examples, I don't know if it is particular to it. I mean, all science fiction, I think, does this double move of both extrapolation and allegory, right? It's maybe not as one-to-one as we'll see in some of the Egyptian examples that I'm going to talk about, but the idea that Western Anglophone science fiction stories aren't also allegories or reflections and critiques of the societies within which they're written, I think is a hard one to establish. And I talked about in the Suvin episode about how most modern science fiction has specifically been read as an allegory in light of his theories and critiques, and in an academic context at least. And maybe this will make more sense after I've talked about some of the Egyptian science fiction books that I've read later on. But, you know, maybe there is a difference in that something like 1984, Brave New World, to quote the big English dystopian examples, extrapolations of, you know, what our society might become if it is left to run amok, and even Frankenstein and stuff as well. The Egyptian examples that I've been able to access are a little more one-to-one, or I guess less extrapolated, in that they're kind of saying this is what Egyptian society is like now. It's already been let run amok, which I'm sure you can find examples of that in the English and other Western traditions as well. But I guess maybe it's a semantic quibble here, because I don't know if this is so much a double estrangement as kind of a half estrangement, right? It is disguising a lack of extrapolation and removal under the guise of kind of a superficial setting. Again, maybe this will come more into focus as we go on, so I'll leave it for now. I'll return to this idea after I've talked about some of the Egyptian science fiction books I've read. But it's also notable that Campbell also argues that through this double estrangement, Arabic science fiction also often draws attention to the drop-off in scientific and technological innovation in the Arabic world since the glory days of Arab Muslim dominance, which he doesn't give a date for, but I guess this is going back all the way even to like the medieval period. But we are seeing here, I think in Campbell's assessment, something that Rebecca Ann Bach was critical of in her book about the Suvin-inspired conception of science fiction, is the emphasis on technology and scientific progress. And she saw that as an aspect of, you know, cultural colonization, which I think she's right to point out was dominant and also promoted by white Anglo-American writers throughout a large part of the 20th century and even earlier, going all the way back to its conception. But I guess to this point, Campbell also notes how, since most Arabic science fiction is written in the modern standard Arabic language, which is used for literature throughout most modern Arabic countries, has also therefore become, he says, nearly the exclusive province of a small class of highly educated people, and has therefore attracted a primarily educated and elite audience instead of being built on a more popular pulp background like US science fiction. Again, I'm not really sure about that comparison. If you look at the early pulp tradition, which again is something I've been doing a bit of research into more recently, you will find a lot of the dominant authors in this tradition are often highly qualified people, and indeed they were specifically seeking out people with scientific backgrounds, but there's a lot of crossover with like literary figures and even like political figures and stuff in the early American pulp science fiction, especially the stuff that carried through and remains influential today. So I'm not sure how accurate that characterization of the US pulp tradition is, but I think this is certainly true of the earlier English romantic and utopian science fiction fantasy traditions, right? You've got, like, as much as Mary and Percy Shelley and Lord Byron stuff were rebels, they were rebels who were allowed to rebel because they were all part of the establishment, right? They were university trained. Lord Byron is a lord. Percy Shelley, you know, is a university educated poet celebrity, and Mary Shelley is the daughter of two literary giants who is enabled to run away with these people because, you know, she's kind of born into it. And I talked about how, you know, Loudon was able to write her mummy story because she was from a high class society who had a lot of money and free time and education, and who spent her days gardening and stuff. And this goes all the way through to, you know, the later utopian authors of the 19th century who were a bit more working class and certainly aligned themselves with the working class. I think H.G. Wells liked to see himself as one of the people, but was also frolicking with politicians and writing government bills, and was not only educated at, but taught at elite science schools and hung out with Aldous Huxley and things. And this is certainly true of the modern fantasy genre, which, you know, even earlier is founded on people like Lord Dunsany and William Morris and people like that. But just going to like later 20th century stuff, Tolkien and Lewis were Oxford professors. And I talked in the, I think it was the Hogfather episode, largely about how a lot of their followers were similarly educated and insulated within that Oxford fantasy tradition. So again, I think this upper class dominance and privilege, while perhaps true of Egyptian science fiction, I do think is largely true of all literary traditions, at least in the early years within the time periods that we're talking about, because those are the people who had not only the education, but the time and the resources to pursue something like writing a novel, whereas other people, you know, have to go to work and then are tired. As I can say, as someone who was churning these podcasts out while we were in the middle of a pandemic and I was stuck at home living off a scholarship, whereas now that has slowed down significantly, when even I, who I think lives an extremely privileged, rather comfortable life, it is difficult to find the time and, more importantly, the energy to produce something like this while working a full-time job, let alone trying to write a novel and things. I don't know, maybe my spirit's just weak, but I get it. I am one of the people. H.G. Wells might not be, but I am. So despite the various options I discussed earlier, Campbell positions the origin of Arabic science fiction much later than a lot of the other critics, treating the early 1960s novels of Mustafa Muhammad as the first examples of what he calls self-conscious Arabic science fiction. I also think it's notable that Campbell describes Muhammad as a Marxist who passed through science fiction on his way to Islamism, so kind of a Western materialist, Western secular materialist origin and influence on his writing, but he does ultimately end up in a, not necessarily Egyptian, but Arabic religious mode, which I don't think necessarily means much given, you know, the prevalence of Christian science fiction writers and things. I think the significant part there is the Marxist background, which speaks more to this Western influence and imitation, perhaps. Now, Muhammad's first science fiction novel, and again, this one's not available in English or even in some kind of Arabic version that I could attempt to translate somehow, so I'm going off Campbell's translations and interpretations here. But yeah, Muhammad's first science fiction novel is from 1965, and it's called The Spider, which is about a bunch of scientists who invent a serum that allows them to experience their past lives. Sounds very Philip K. Dickish, which he would have been around for about a decade at this point, you know, if Muhammad had access to, I guess, contemporary American pulps and paperbacks. So maybe influenced by what's going on in America at the time. Though also maybe just it's the middle of the 60s and everyone's on psychedelics, or so I'm led to believe. The name of the novel, The Spider, a reference to the fact that the serum is derived from some kind of spider venom or compound or something. But it is also, and this again speaks to a very distinct Western influence here,
Campbell says a reference to a bunch of early Fritz Lieber stories, which are mentioned in Muhammad's text. So those being Spider Mansion from 1942, Diary in the Snow from 1947, and The Mind Spider from 1948, all of which I haven't read and know nothing about. Lieber is kind of a blank spot in my science fiction fantasy knowledge. I mean, I will be getting well into Fafhrd and the Grey Mauser for when we get to The Color of Magic and the other early wizard novels. But outside of that, I think I've only read a few of his books, Conjure Wife, and I think The Wanderer and The Big Time, which I think he won the Hugo Awards for. But he's more someone I know of than whose work I know particularly intimately. But it seems like Muhammad certainly did. But Kimball goes on to analyze Muhammad's Spider in terms of Al-Talawi's 1990 monograph on science fiction stories in Arabic literature, which Kimball credits as the first book-length study of Arabic science fiction. But Kimball summarizes Al-Talawi's arguments, being that he says science fiction is indeed a valid literary genre in Arabic, but that it is only an immature one, both because of the lack of scientific and technological progress created by Arabs in the 20th century, and because, he says, Arabic science fiction writers, at least in 1990, had so far failed to create innovations in the form or narrative of their works as well. And instead, Al-Talawi argues that Arabic science fiction is instead infused with what he calls a hereditary memory that gives rise to an obsession with the glorious past of Arabic society, so that the locus of progress lies in their past, not their future, which might sound rather familiar to readers of Pyramids. And Campbell says that in the novel, it is the Arab mentality that still glorifies the past and still preserves what's left as a sincere attempt to reconcile its existence with this age where things change quickly around it. But more importantly, for our purposes at least, he argues that if we confront this clinging to the past with what happens in Western stories, we find that the authors made their protagonists positively disposed to progress. He says, because the Western desire to hold on to the past is much lower than that of seeking the future, but that the opposite is true from the Arab perspective. So Campbell's arguing that from the outset of a fully solidified, codified, what he says, self-conscious Arabic and Egyptian science fiction tradition, that it is seemingly stuck clinging to the past. And I'm not sure if he's talking about the plot itself or the style of writing and the authorial voice, but again, I don't know how widespread and accurate that is. And that is something that Buck and other critics of largely male-dominated Anglo-American science fiction of the mid to late 20th century, you know, criticize. But indeed, as with a lot of the other examples I brought up so far, there does seem to be this preoccupation with the past from the Spider's about revisiting past lives and things. Then there does seem to be in the Western and English-speaking traditions, which albeit provide a much broader berth of examples here. So, but of the ones we have, or that Campbell and these other scholars mentioned, there does seem to be this ongoing thread and preoccupation with the past. Conversely, Muhammad's third science fiction novel, which Campbell translates as Man Below Zero, describes a, and which won the Egyptian State Prize in Literature in 1970. I'm not sure what the timeline there is, but this book describes a future Arab utopia and a machine that can turn people into waveforms. And Campbell says that by extrapolating technological development 100 years into the future, Muhammad illustrates the contradiction at the heart of mid-20th century Egyptian society, which is that despite having millions of skilled workers, the country cannot generate enough economic activity to employ them. Again, I'm not really sure I follow how the time travel exposes the structural economic problems. I mean, I think the argument he's making is it would be unrealistic to place some kind of utopia in the modern or even closer to the modern day because the country is so far off that and there's such a gap between employment from now to then that to make it realistic, or I guess believable in this cognitive sense, it has to be set so far ahead in the future as to be almost completely detached from the modern society. And this speaks to Campbell's idea of the double estrangement. And he says, you know, this is a matter of politics and sense, and that were Muhammad to stand up and make this point directly in 1966, he would likely be arrested, jailed, and potentially tortured for criticizing President Mohammad Nasser's regime. Therefore, he has to employ this so-called double estrangement to disguise, albeit rather thinly, his social critique so that he can plead ignorance and say, no, I'm not talking about Egypt. I'm talking about this imaginary future Egypt where everyone's a wave and things. It couldn't possibly be about us, which again, I think is something that, you know, gets employed going all the way back to
through the original satirists in ancient Greece and things, but also just within sort of the more modern early science fictional and proto-science fictional tradition. This is what Gulliver's Travels is, essentially, right? And certainly Mary Shelley's Last Man is a critique of current expansionism and colonialism disguised as an apocalyptic plague set hundreds of years in the future. So a common, albeit dominant, strategy being employed by Muhammad, who Campbell credits as sort of the originator of the modern Egyptian science fiction tradition. I mean, I would be very interested in getting a translation of these novels and checking them out, both from an academic and historical curiosity, but also because Past Life Serum science fiction sounds pretty trippy and cool, and I would be up for that. Now, these tendencies towards both, you know, temporal utopian extrapolation and thinly veiled social critique carry through in another one of the major Egyptian examples that Campbell analyzes in his book, which is a novel called The Conqueror of Time from about a decade later in 1972 by Nahid Sharif, who you may recall from Elsenby's periodization. He was characterized as the dominant Egyptian science fiction author of the 70s and 80s. And yeah, having read both Campbell's book and these other ones, Sharif, he seems like the guy. I don't know if this necessarily makes him the best, but he seems like the biggest and most influential and perhaps most interesting writer, certainly of his period, if not the entire Egyptian tradition itself. And according to Campbell, at least, differs from earlier authors in the Egyptian science fiction tradition in that rather than an imitation or continuation Western science fiction, Sharif apparently considered Arabic science fiction to be its own separate tradition that was derived from a distinctly Arabic tradition of fantasy fiction, though he doesn't really give any evidence or reference for this claim. And when Campbell does give the example of Sharif defining what he calls disciplined science fiction as, quote, fiction based on fixed scientific truth that is extended and completed by means of that imagination which is founded on studied and potentially achievable assumptions, we're essentially getting Suvin's cognitive estrangement being reworded here. So whether they arrived at it in a roundabout way from the same set of influences or by, you know, parallel development, the foundations, the philosophies of the tradition seem to be pretty similar, if not identical. But yeah, Sharif seems like a pretty big deal both in Egyptian science fiction, but also just general Egyptian literature. His 1981 novel, The Thing, which came out 1 year before the Carpenter film, although that is itself a remake of the 1951 Thing from Outer Space, but Sneer describes that novel as one of the most prominent novels of Arabic science fiction and one of the first steps in its canonization, having been published by the official literary center in Egypt, although it certainly sounds a bit pulpier than these other examples I've discussed, being a religiously themed novel about the arrival of a flying saucer, which suggests that ancient Egyptians were capable of space flight and also had built pyramids on both the moon and Mars. So highbrow stuff. Indeed, I think also notable is Sharif's 1983 story, Encounter with Khufu's Granddaughter, which similarly postulates that ancient Egyptians had migrated to one of Uranus's moons before returning to Earth in modern times. So kind of the ancient aliens call is a little bit coming from inside the house here, although I guess the difference is rather than aliens coming and taking credit for all the things the Egyptians did, because Western colonial authors and cultures couldn't believe that they actually, you know, were capable of making them themselves. It's sort of going the other way and the Egyptians were so good, they were actually the aliens, right? They taught the aliens how to build spaceships and whatnot. Yeah, I haven't read these. I'm sort of imagining 2001 A Space Odyssey in reverse, where we're leaving, or the Egyptians are leaving pyramid monoliths on Uranus in case any of the Neptunians are evolved enough to invent spaceflight, and then maybe we'll help them out, get to Jupiter and blow it up and turn it into a sun and whatnot. But yeah, the Book of Sharif's that Campbell provides a prolonged examination of, which I mentioned earlier, is a 1972 novel whose title Campbell translates as The Conqueror of Time. I think I saw it in one of the other books I've incited here as Time Conqueror. But yeah, some combination of conquering and time going on there. And this is about a scientist who invents cryogenic freezing technology. Stop me if you've kind of heard this one before. But yeah, this is another book where we had the protagonist, Camille, who wakes up in the future after being frozen for 100 years in future Egypt to discover a utopian age of Halim, where in Cairo is the world's capital and Arab Arabic is the global language, and Egypt has once again risen to power and is a political and technological leader in the world. Now, from Campbell's plot summary, turns out I think this is ultimately a hallucination, and Camille wakes up in a prison cell. He discovers a secret underground laboratory where science have preserved themselves in cryosleep, presumably in an attempt to bring about such a future, but then this lab is destroyed in a fire, although evidence of its existence persists, with the epilogue suggesting its possible recovery in the future. So there's a lot going on there, both in terms of Campbell's conception of double estrangement, by which he says Sharif presents Egyptian society as a stagnant and figuratively frozen in its obsession with the past. And if you're starting to put the pieces together here, right, this is the way Egypt, or its doubly estranged Egyptian society of Jelly Baby, is depicted in Pratchett's pyramids. Now, albeit rather than ancient Egypt, it's sort of modern post-1950s revolution Egypt, but there's this emphasis on progress, or its lack and its stagnation. Where Sharif differs from Pratchett, though, is in his emphasis on Egypt's historical role as technological and scientific leaders. In addition to the things that happen to him in a plot, the protagonist, Camille, is also a historian who is writing a book about the history of astronomy in Egypt, the explicit purpose of which Campbell claims is to remind his Egyptian readers of their glorious history of scientific development, right? This is kind of like what we later see Pratchett doing in Nation, and Campbell says Sharif thereby draws parallels between the modern integration of science and technology into contemporary Egyptian culture, with Egyptian advances in the sciences during the medieval period, when Egypt was the richest and most developed part of the Middle East, while also providing a distorted reflection on the consequences of Nasir's rule, which Sharif seems to be saying had led to this technological stagnation. So, you know, completely different genres, periods, cultural backgrounds, but both Sharif and Pratchett seem to be saying that the Egyptian analogues are stuck in this backwards-looking cultural and technological stagnation that is brought about by a very implicitly corrupt and, you know, progress-stomping out government, while also pointing out, you know, the previous technological marvels that their society has been capable of achieving in terms of the medieval astronomy in Shafir's work, but also in the pyramids in Pratchett's pyramids, where, you know, amidst all this supposed stagnation, we also get the pataclosps, or I guess Liz pointed this out in one of her emails, because of the P being before all the name, that they should be pronounced tclusp, and that I have obviously picked up pataclosp from Nigel Planer's pronunciation in the audiobook version, where he also says Petrachi instead of Tracy and things, but I guess with Tracy there, you drop the P, you've got the name, the joke's there. I'm not sure what tclusp is meant to mean, so pataclosp makes a bit more sense, and also just sounds a bit better than hitting that hard T on tclusp. But yeah, if anyone has any idea what that might be meaning to allude to, email me at unseenacademicals@gmail.com and let me know. But yeah, we get them in there as they're sort of saying, hey, the Egyptians were this like technologically forward-thinking marvels. They just didn't keep going with that. That seems to be the implication of Pratchett's narrative. And this, I want to say, is reflected in Sharif's novel, but of course Sharif's novel came first. But yeah, we get this same kind of implication in Conqueror of Time, with Campbell pointing out that although cryogenics are the primary and ostensible novum of the novel, what is truly new and different about its Egyptian society is that it values rigor, evidence, proof, and science. This is what causes the societal shift and the new utopian arrangement the characters witness. It's not the cryogenics that bring about this utopia, it is just a device to get them to the future to witness everything else that is a result of 100 years worth of scientific progress and societal restructuring. And also, rather importantly, that it is that in this 100 years, there has been some kind of nuclear war that's sort of been a hard reset on, I guess, the rest of the world, but specifically Egypt as well. And Campbell says this is particularly significant because the implication is that such a societal restructuring and re-emphasis on technology and progress and things is sufficiently implausible in terms of modern Egypt as to require the intervention of an imagined nuclear war. So it would take something that drastic to bring them back to where they were and where, I guess, at least Sharif wants them to go. But despite Sharif's supposed allegiance to a distinctly Arabic science fiction tradition, Dedeman, the alien guy, which, yeah, he's the one who translates its title as Time Conqueror, but he interprets the novel as not just an expression of Sharif's pride in Egyptian science, but also of his fascination with English and French fiction. Noting that one of the characters, which I think might be the protagonist, finds themselves becoming tired of the realism and traditionalism of Egyptian literature, which they previously praise in the novel as noble, grandiose, and eternal, before turning towards the wider horizon of Western writers like Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, and Aldous Huxley, which he says follow the method of science. So yeah, doing the same thing Muhammad was doing with his references to Fritz Lieber, right? This seems to fly in the face of Sharif's supposed assertion of a separate Arabic tradition and really just say and reveal his debt to these popular Western writers, but also getting kind of the inverse thing where if science fiction is fiction, at least in its earlier sense, it's fiction inspired by science, right? Mary Shelley thinks about the galvanism experiments and goes, oh, what if you did this with a person and extrapolates from there. This is science fiction inspiring scientific progress, or at least the desire for scientific progress in the real world, but also, and I think very significantly, a desire for scientific progress within the characters as the driver motivational force in the story itself, which I guess does sort of fly in the face of something like Frankenstein, which I think is largely read as a warning against scientific hubris and ambition. Although I'm becoming less convinced of that reading with each subsequent reread of that novel. I think there's some pretty deliberate underminings of that ideology in that book. I mean, ultimately it's ambiguous, but I think it's less clear cut than a lot of the later interpretations and adaptations seem to take it as being, but also giving us another kind of implicit, but I think pretty telling connection to Pratchett's Pyramids, as that Campbell says of the novel's end, where the cryogenics lab is sealed off, burned, and apparently buried with inside a mountain. But Campbell says that ultimately the social and intellectual consequences of cryogenics prove too disruptive to contemporary Egyptian society, and that the scientist and his laboratory are contained within what he translates as a patching, as a means of insulating real-world Egypt from the potential danger of technology. So again, it's kind of backwards in that we have this technological enclave being sealed off from the rest of the allegedly backwards-looking, stagnant world within the narrative, but the meta implication of that is that it is the other way around, in that this potential for technological progress and the realization of the kind of utopia shown in the future section of Sharif's novel has been sealed off, right, polded by the real-world Egyptian government and the political situation that the country's citizens have found themselves in. So then we get another inversion in that, rather than the letting in of modern time into these fantasy pocket dimensions in, traditional fantasy and fairy tales and things, this is more the implication of this sectioned off, this polded technological enclave, which is represented, I think, both within the book, and if I can get wanky for a second, by the book itself. The book contains the scientific, not knowledge, but emphasis and promotion, and that by unleashing that into the world of the story, but by reading the book and inspiring these thoughts within the mind of the reader, we're breaking that polder barrier and letting the technological advancement spill out and into the broader, more backwards thinking world, right? It's an opposite arrangement. So yeah, quite a lot of thematic and conceptual crossovers with Pratchett's Pyramids, even if I think they're coming at the same sort of subjects with the same sort of ideas from completely different directions and arriving at somewhat of the same thought, I guess the same conceptualization of what the problem is, except Pratchett playing on these colonial stereotypes is sort of saying, well, it's Egypt's problem, or Sharif is saying it's Egypt's corrupt, oppressive government's problem, which I guess is the same sort of thing Pratchett's saying, right? It is Deos who is keeping Jelly Baby held back in Pyramids, just that his revolution comes from the top down through Tepic rather than a complete resistance to an overthrow and usurpation of the government that seems to be implied by Sharif and these other Egyptian writers, I think would be supported by someone like Suvin and other historical materialists, which is to say Marxists. I mean, I don't have the historical context nor the cultural nuance to make this comparison, but I do wonder, how much of Nasir went into the character of Deos. Like, is he more than just a parody of the evil Grand Vizier archetype? Is he a reflection of contemporary, at the time when Pratchett was writing this, contemporary Egyptian politics as seen from Pratchett's UK-based perspective? Like, I don't know, and if I hadn't already done 3 episodes, this might be a whole rabbit hole I go down and research, but I think I'm going to leave that one for now. But if there's anyone out there who does have the understanding and nuance to sort of unpack that, I would love to hear about it, though I imagine that is a pretty specialized request. And if I'm not going to do it, I don't imagine anyone else necessarily is. But while Pratchett might not be privy to nor that particularly interested in the Egyptian science fiction tropes and traditions and things like that, I think he certainly would have been aware of the big picture when it came to NASA and things like that. Another, I guess, less serious parallel Pratchett that I just wanted to point out since it came up in Campbell's analysis of Conqueror of Time, and that is that he says the novel contains a medical doctor who Campbell characterizes as the only female character in the book with anything like agency, though he also notes that Sharif feels the need to remind us several times that she's also fat. So unfortunately, another carryover tradition there with all of Pratchett's seemingly capable women. So yeah, this book sounds extremely interesting, and yeah, it is thoroughly explained and explored in Campbell's chapter. I don't know if I've done a particularly good job of translating that here, but if there's one of these books that I would really like to be translated so I can read it, I think it's this one. I mean, maybe the ideas in Campbell's analysis are more interesting than the narrative itself, but this seems like the one. And yeah, I find it really weird that given Sharif's prominence and sort of literary respectability, that these works haven't been translated into English as far as I know, and that his works aren't among the small handful of our more modern English translations that have begun to crop up in the last few years, which I guess is probably in part due to the Egyptian Science Fiction Society, which I'm going to talk about now. So that takes us through the exploratory and founding waves of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and up to around the time Pratchett is writing and publishing Pyramids, which is just before what Elsenby, I think again rather harshly, identified as the spreading wave of Egyptian science fiction in the 1990s, which, if you recall, he described as an arid period for the genre with only a handful of prominent authors. I'll talk a bit more about this later on, because I think it'll just make more sense with the progression there. But in general, this seems to be a pulpier period for the genre. So a bit of literary and genre chauvinism showing through on Elsenby's part there, which I think continues when we jump forward to 2011. And the beginning of what Elsenby calls the authenticity period for Egyptian science fiction. Now, this, of course, coincides with the Arab Spring and the 2011 Egyptian revolution, which saw the overthrow of the longstanding Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, and control of the government was essentially taken over by the military under the guise of the rather friendly-sounding Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, and has been somewhat tumultuous since then. We'll get onto that in a bit. But the year after 2012 also coincides with Elsenby's founding of the Egyptian Society for Science Fiction, which is something he says Sharif had attempted previously on a number of occasions, though I don't have the evidence or citation for that, but it was finally achieved in 2012 by Elsenby, who was and is still an ophthalmologist, so a medical eye doctor, who specializes in keratoconus and cross-linking, which I just bring up because that is what I have in my eye that makes it difficult to read for very long periods. And the cross-linking procedure, I've spent the better part of a year battling with the medical system to get that operation going, which I realize the fact that it's even going to happen is pretty special and is preferable to a lot of other countries' medical systems, but it has been an absolute bureaucratic nightmare trying to get the different departments to talk to each other and talk to me and actually work out what's going on. But anyway, hopefully that should happen in a few months or at least sometime later this year. But yeah, this is why I say it is kind of self-serving that Elsenby associates the establishment of his science fiction society with a more authentic wave of Egyptian science fiction, whereby he says the genre started to taste more Egyptian, more Arabic, and may also be more Islamic, as well as having a greater focus on diversity and a growing number of female authors. So a concerted or at least signaled attempt to break away from the more Western influence tradition of earlier Egyptian science fiction, while also opening it up to more marginalized groups of authors, which is all rather admirable. Although from what I can see, at least with the stuff that is available to me, which again, is probably biased in that it is trying to appeal to me as a Western English speaking and reading reader, it does seem that Egyptian science fiction, or at least the internationally successful and available examples, are still heavily influenced and reliant on the Western and Anglo-American traditions. I mean, Elsenby himself has a chapter on Egyptian science fiction in his and Ahmed al-Din Ashir's 2022 collection on Arab and Muslim science fiction, wherein he explains his history with the genre, writing that his time living in the UK and US was what actually facilitated both his exposure to and personal production of science fiction, right, saying that he was first exposed to the genre when he saw Star Wars as a teenager in the United Kingdom. He doesn't give a date for that, but looking at the timeline, I think this was probably the re-releases that they got in the 90s in the lead up to The Phantom Menace, when I also got to see them in the cinemas and things. But either way, Elsenby talks about three science fiction novels he wrote later while studying in the US, which he says were published in Egypt in 2001. I can't find any other record of these books' existence, which is possibly due to translation issues. He talks about these books and gives their titles exclusively in English in this chapter, but I think maybe he wrote them in Arabic. But his description of their plots, which again, these predate his authenticity wave by 10 years, so I'm not saying we should be there yet, but they're pretty in keeping with the stuff we've seen from Sharif and Muhammad and all the other Egyptian science fiction authors I've described here. He describes his first novel, The Great Space Saga, or The Half-Humans, as a space colonization or first contact novel, which is centered around a voyage to Titan. And he says that, like his precursors, his book similarly articulated our dream of a single united nation that is scientifically advanced and equally participates with Western civilization and other human civilizations to boost the advanced path of mankind. Again, this more technologically advanced Egyptian or Arabic society reinstating itself as a technological world leader, which is embodied in the novel by a democratic and egalitarian union of Muslim states, which he says was modeled on the European Union, which also appears in his second novel, The Planet of the Viruses. And then to round things out, we have his third novel, which is a dystopian future novel called America 2030, The Story of the End of the World. So I think what we have there are two books, you know, lifting up Egypt and presenting them in this future utopian light, and one sort of dragging down America and presenting its future as distinctly dystopian, which I haven't read this book and we're still a few years off, but given they're going to actually let Trump run for office again and we're going to have to go through all that shit again, you know, seems like he's probably on the money with that one, at least. But yeah, he wrote these three books in America, and then they were all published in Egypt in 2001, so I don't know over what period they were written, but he hasn't put anything out, or at least doesn't describe himself in this chapter, which is all I have to go off, as putting anything out since returning to Egypt, whose atmosphere he describes as being rather stifling to creativity, saying that you can't hardly drive in the roads in Egypt without being honked at or finding terrible and inexplicable things happening in front of you that could cost your life, or at least your sanity, all of which he finds very off-putting to the creative and aesthetic drive, although he also notes the increased workload and responsibilities of marriage and family life and running two medical clinics. So, you know, I think as much as he might want to blame this on Egypt's atmosphere, you know, I find it hard enough to put together and put out these podcasts on time, and I'm not running two medical clinics and a science fiction association and have a wife and kids and a family and everything. So I think there might be some extenuating circumstances there as well. But despite all this, Elsenby continues to characterize Egypt as the leader of the novel and the short story in the Arab world, along with being a leader in the literary genres of realism and science fiction, and says beyond the establishment of a dedicated science fiction publishing house in Egypt, which is something his society achieved in 2020, the only thing really remaining to do for the genre, short of soliciting government support, is to get Arab television and movie producers interested in science fiction. And to some extent, both of these things have already started to happen. I mean, if you recall from my descriptions of the earlier science fiction authors, Muhammad's Man Below Zero, which was the one about turning people into waveforms, that already won the 1970 Egyptian State Prize in Literature. And then we also had Sharif's 1981 novel, The Thing, being published by Egypt's official literary center. So there has been some government support for these prominent, albeit already established, science fiction authors in the past. And as for the television thing, there have been three notable science fiction and fantasy TV series that all debuted in 2020. There's one called Every Week Has a Friday, which the description of is kind of vague. It seems like there's a weird sort of maybe time loop thing happening there, perhaps. I'm not really sure. But then we also have a kind of horror thriller series called Room 207, which is based on a novel of the same name, or its Egyptian translation, by Ahmed Khalid Tawfiq. And then also, and most prominently, the Egyptian Netflix series Paranormal, which was the first original series produced by Netflix in Egypt, which is essentially like Supernatural, the American TV series about, you know, paranormal investigators running into, you know, fantasy monsters and things, and was apparently pretty successful, at least in the Arabic-speaking world. I haven't watched this yet, but there is only one season of 6 episodes so far, so I might endeavor to watch that, and if I do and it's worth talking about, I'll drop in some diddly-doos here and we can flash forward and see what I think about that. Now, this this is also based on Tewfik's work, Tewfik or Tewfik, not really sure how to say that, and it is spelt differently depending on where you go. It's either Tewfik with an O or Tewfik with an A, so I might just alternate between either. I mean, this is also based on Tewfik's work, in this case being a series he wrote, which variously translates as supernatural or metaphysical or paranormal, right? So the series is essentially called Supernatural. But yeah, this consists of a series of 81 monthly novellas that were written by Tewfik between 1994 and 2014. Tewfik did actually die a few years later in 2018, which is probably why they stopped. But this series, it's essentially along the same lines as the American Supernatural. So rather than science fiction, it's more horror, paranormal investigation stuff. But it's also based heavily on Western figures and tropes, right? I mean, just looking over the list of the titles, there's references to stories about vampires, but also specifically Dracula, Frankenstein, and Igors. And we also get titles like The Legend of the Pharaoh's Curse and The Legend of the Mummy. So yes, as much as I am looking for, you know, examples of specifically Egyptian fantasy and science fiction that is written from an Egyptian perspective, I do really want to get my hands on, or I guess my eyes, my fading eyes, on a translation of some of these to see how these Western tropes that deal in portrayals of Egypt are then reversed and portrayed by Egyptian writers who are working with Western representations. Yeah, I think it would be interesting. So that's the kind of stuff I'm after. Unfortunately, it's not available.
So I watched the first three episodes of Paranormal Now, and the first episode, which was about a haunted house, it was a bit more stylized, had a bit more in common with the Mike Flanagan series, like The Haunting of Hill House and Bly Manor and The House of Usher and all of those. But yeah, it quickly devolved into more supernatural-esque pulp nonsense that by the third episode had become pretty silly. But the second episode, which is catchily called The Myth of the Curse of the Pharaoh, is an adaptation of one or two fixed mummy stories, and it started off hinting like there was maybe going to be some extra political dimensions and things, but no, it's just a pretty straightforward, you know, pulp adventure mummy story that you'd expect from a trashy Western writer, as much as it seems, yeah, an Egyptian one as well. There was one moment of possible insight where they were talking about the legend of the Pharaoh's curse and things, because in this one there's two mummies, a king and a queen. They have to be reunited, and the main character dismisses this myth initially, pointing out that this is just a rehash of the ancient Egyptian myth of Isis and Osiris. And I thought, hey, that's a pretty good insight, and, you know, probably some basis for why these mummy's curse stories are wrapped up in these, you know, separated lost lovers and things like that I talked about in the previous episode. But I'm not sure, like, how closely that really maps, because the myth of Isis is Osiris is killed by Set, and then she brings him back from the dead, and then he judges people. So there's something about bringing your lover back from the dead, but it's not really like the mummy coming back from the dead and seeking his lost love. It's the live person bringing their lover back. I don't know. I'm sure there's versions and nuances and things, but just from a quick glance, I'm not really sure how insightful that is, but I'm sure it is a part of the story. Yeah, I haven't watched the last three episodes. As I said, I was pretty checked out by that third one, but yeah, I'll go back to them at some point and maybe watch the other couple of movies that I mentioned as well, but I haven't done that yet, and it's not worth pushing back this episode anymore for. So if there's anything interesting in them, I'll drop it on a future episode or something like that.
Similarly, in the 1980s, so a bit before Tewfik series, we also had another series called The Future File by the Egyptian author Nabil Farouk, which were similar sort of detective novels with various science fiction elements. And he also had a series called Fantasia, wherein an Egyptian housewife apparently uses a dream-generating computer to visit various fictional worlds, including those by prominent Western authors such as Dostoevsky and Arthur Conan Doyle and things like that. So yeah, even these authors who seem like they're writing in more of a popular pulp mode as compared to the more literary utopian works of the earlier authors I discussed, they're still remaining pretty reliant and indebted to the figures and tropes of the Western science fiction traditions. But yeah, these series, from what I can tell, proved incredibly popular, leading to Tewfik being touted as the Arab world's best-selling author of horror and fantasy genres, and his first full standalone novel, Utopia, from 2009, becoming, as far as I know at least, the first Egyptian science fiction novel that was officially translated into English, with that translation coming out in 2011, so around the same time as the Egyptian Revolution. Now, as its title ironically suggests, this is a pretty standard dystopian novel set in a future Egypt following the collapse of the oil industry. The US invents a new, more environmentally efficient superfuel called Biroil, which then, you know, this is all sort of background in the novel rather than detailed, but this has, you know, significant economic implications for Egypt and the Middle East are no longer able to profit off oil and things, and result somehow in the division of the population into a group of rich hedonists who live inside this walled compound, and then the poor people who live in squalor outside its walls and in the surrounding areas. So quite similar to Claire G. Coleman's Enclave, which I talked about in my Worst Books I Read Last Year podcast. I still didn't love this book, and I think it's still kind of basic, but it's certainly more complex and thought out than that book was. But something else it is rather like is The Hunger Games, because the, you know, the thrust of the story is the main character, who's a guy who's living in the rich compound. Yeah, he gets bored, and when kids in the rich place get bored, they go out into the poor place and go hunting and try and kill poor people and bring back their heads and trophies and things, in some pretty unsubtle social commentary there. But yeah, this does come out in Egypt in 2009, so a year after the Hunger Games, and of course there were similar stories earlier on, like Battle Royale and things, but they were more niche. Before that, I do wonder, like, how much of this is possibly a response to the Hunger Games, whether it would have got big enough and become available to Egyptian readers early enough for it to be an influence on this work, though if it was going to be available to anyone, Torfik, as the nation's most prominent fantasy and science fiction writer, would probably be aware of it before most. But yeah, this book essentially boils down to the Hunger Games plus Brave New World plus poverty tourism. You know, the guy goes out to go hunt poor people and stuff happens. He falls in with them and he gets led around the city by the sort of secondary narrator who shows him all the suffering of all the people in the city, you know, so that you think he's becoming more sympathetic to their plight. But then the twist on things is that at the end, when there's a standoff between the group of poor people that our protagonist has fallen in with and the rich state that we're from, he then turns on the poor people immediately and massacres them all. The point being that, you know, the rich people aren't going to change just because you show them the suffering of the poor. So a bit of a subversion going on there. That's actually set in 2023, so last year, or at least my version is, in an article he's written about the book. Campbell has a whole footnote where he scolds people for saying that the book's set in 2023 when the text quite clearly states that it's set in 2020. I don't know if this is a translation thing, but at least the English digital version that I have access to quite clearly stated that it was set in 2023. But I thought that's interesting, both because of the proximity to now when I'm recording this, but also, you know, this speaks to the double estrangement thing that Campbell is arguing for and using this book as primary evidence for, of, or what I would call the half estrangement thing, where this book is hardly removed from actual Egypt and the current time, and is a pretty thinly veiled allegory about the current government and conditions and things. And, you know, when I first started reading it, I was kind of thinking, you know, of all the novels, why this one? You know, why not one of Sharif or Muhammad's novels? But yeah, I guess Tawfiq is quite successful. And then if you translate this novel rather than one of the supernatural ones, you don't have to do the whole series. But also that, yes, this is quite a serious novel with some pretty obvious connections to the then ongoing Arab Spring and the Egyptian Revolution. So in retrospect, that makes sense. Although, yeah, I found it something that definitely stood out while reading this, which I don't necessarily recommend anyone does unless they're super interested in Egyptian science fiction and things. But I mean, I've already said this book echoes Western works like Brave New World and The Hunger Games and things. But in addition to that, it makes heavy reference to works of Western culture and science fiction, right? The opening scene, it begins with a discussion of the film Platoon, where the narrator is looking at a poster of the film that he has hung up on his wall and essentially sketches out the themes of the book in his analysis of this poster, right? War is bad, violence is bad, all of that. But yeah, showing a heavy debt to American, and specifically American-centric in Platoon's case, media there. But we also get references throughout the text to works like Edgar Edgar Allan Poe's Mask of the Red Death and the films of Charlie Chaplin, and the narrator also quotes people like Thomas Malthus, George Orwell, and H.G. Wells, which is perhaps putting a link between the westernization of Egypt and the violence it commits, but also I think just showing these as references and touchstones for the type of work that Tawfiq's writing here. And something else I found interesting, just because of me, as this book also puts a lot of emphasis on a new genre of music that's been invented, which is called orgasm music, which we don't really get a description of other than to say that it is even more extreme than death metal. So that is how bleak things have become in the future 2023 Egypt. But this music thing, it jumped out to me, obviously, because I'm interested in death metal, but also it cropped up in a couple of the other translations of Egyptian science fiction novels that I read, which, yeah, I'm going to conclude this episode by quickly giving my thoughts on. So yeah, to my knowledge, in addition to Tawfiq's Utopia, there are four other, you know, officially published English translations of Egyptian science fiction novels so far. Most significant is probably Mohamed Rabi's Otterid from 2014, which was translated into English in 2016. And this book is essentially Taxi Driver, but set in a near future Egypt following another failed revolution. I mean, it doesn't begin with the protagonist looking at a Taxi Driver poster and saying, I was thinking about Taxi Driver, and that's why I behaved like Taxi Driver, but just in terms of a broad sketch of the type of story it's telling, is a possible Western influence. Its title, Otterid, is a translation of Mercury, which is the main guy's last name. Not sure if that is significant as some kind of westernized influence there, but I just thought I'd point it out in case it is. This book is full on. Like, it begins with a scene of a father murdering and eating his entire family, and then there is some stuff later on that I found quite disturbing. I mean, a lot of these books are just endless scenes of graphic violence, but these ones kind of really hit. If you go back to my description of some of the scenes, my reaction to them in American Psycho, in my best books that I read last year podcast, these is the kind of stuff that's kind of stuck with me in the same way. Yeah, there's some pretty nasty stuff in this book, and it's pretty unrelenting, and then the whole thing turns out that it's possibly a time loop, or at least the protagonist is perceiving it as one. I don't know whether that's, I mean, it's left somewhat ambiguous. I think he's probably just deluded, but the idea that Egypt is hell and he is experiencing the same hell over and over again, which again, speaking to Campbell's double or half estrangement thing, you know, this is a thinly veiled analogy for the Egyptian government, which after the revolution in 2011, they got a new president and then they kicked him out with another revolution because they didn't like him. And then they got a new one now that people don't like, so that it's the new boss same as the old boss thing, but with a lot of murder and child rape to get the point across, I guess. And yeah, this also has the other example of extreme music that I was talking about that sort of points this out as some kind of trope Egyptian dystopian literature, in that here we have a new genre of music which is made up of samples of animals being slaughtered, which then throughout the book, you know, this is compared to the Egyptian people being slaughtered like animals by their government. There's some stuff about vegetarianism in there that I won't go into, but that is a trope that it is leaning on, that it connects to extreme music in the same way that Tawfiq kind of did with his orgasm music. I'm not sure what's going on there, but it jumped out to me as kind of interesting, given my interest in both extreme music and the intersection of animal ethics and dystopian science fiction and human subjugation and things. Nevertheless, this book was nominated for, or perhaps because of these disturbing depictions, the book was nominated for the International Prize for Arabic Fiction, which it didn't win, but the same award was won the previous year by Iraqi author Ahmed Sardoui's Frankenstein in Baghdad from 2013, which has also been translated in English. This was the first science fiction, or I guess science fictional novel, to win the award. This is a book about, it's a Frankensteinian homunculus monster who's made up of body parts from war victims and things, and then who goes around the streets of Baghdad taking revenge for war crimes and brutality and stuff that's been committed on the Iraqi people. Again, like in Otterid, could be, is implied to be perhaps hallucinatory, although I think in Frankenstein and Baghdad there is more of an argument to be made that there is an actual monster rather than them actually being in hell in Otterid, or at least the ambiguity is a bit more complex there. But yes, very similar novels. Don't let it ever be said that you know, literary prizes, as distinct from genre ones, don't have specific tropes and things that they latch onto and like to reward. The other translation collections, which I won't go into as much detail about, but we have The Q by Basma Abdelaziz from 2013, which was translated in 2016, and is the only one of these books, well, apart from Frankenstein in Baghdad, but that's Iraqi rather than the Egyptian. It's the only one of these Egyptian translation that I found was available as an audiobook. This is on Audible if you're interested in checking it out. Again, I probably wouldn't recommend it unless you have a specialized interest like I do. Stop me if you've heard this one before, but this is another satirical dystopia about a fictional future Arabic state whose citizens all live in an unmoving queue while they wait for various pieces of paperwork and stuff that they need to be processed by a totalitarian government who is also constantly rewriting history to cover up its war crimes. So very 1984, and again, an example of this thinly veiled double or half estrangement that we have going on here. Another one, and I think the best and most interesting of these Egyptian translation is the novel Using Life, or The Use of Life, by the Egyptian journalist Ahmed Naji from 2014 and translated in 2017. This is a loosely science fiction novel. It has maybe a bit more, not magical realism, but maybe postmodernist surrealism, although I think there is a significant and largely unrecognized overlap with postmodernism and science fiction that I might go into on another podcast sometime. But yeah, this is a book about a secret underground urban planning society that controls the future through its clandestine cultural and environmental influences, which is a really interesting premise and rather different to all these other books that I've been describing so far, though again, it is set in the near future following a failed revolution and goes into graphic detail about, well, I guess less violence in this case, but certainly the hedonistic excesses of the Egyptian people under this oppressive rule. I mean, a doki-doki fact about this, albeit I think quite a significant one, is that Naji was in fact sentenced to 2 years in prison after someone complained that an excerpt from this novel that was published in an Egyptian literary journal had harmed public morality. He served almost a year of that sentence before he was freed. Whereupon he was awarded the Barbary Freedom to Write Award from PEN America, which gives grants to writers who have been punished for free speech and things. And yeah, he ended up moving to America, where he continues to live and write now. So probably a good call there. If you were going to check out one of these books, I would maybe recommend this one, though it is a bit more complex than all of the others. Like, it's all told out of order, and a lot of the plot is largely implicit in things. I found it very interesting. And finally, we have Women of Karantina by Nail Elatouki from 2013, translated in 2014. This is about a succession of female crime bosses and is set, you guessed it, in a near future following a failed revolution, and details violent excesses and a cyclical progression throughout history. I didn't actually finish this one. I got about a third of the way through it, and I couldn't do it. This is a much longer book than all the others, and yeah, didn't seem to be offering all that new in terms of its themes and narrative. I might go back to it at some point, but I think by that point, yeah, I'd had enough. I got the gist. But yeah, all of this is to say that Egyptian science fiction, or at least, and I think importantly here, the type of Egyptian science fiction that is rewarded, valued, and disseminated by both Western and Middle Eastern literary establishments is, so far at least, on a pretty narrow scope, both in terms of its plot, its themes, the things it's addressing. I mean, these are all related to the Egyptian revolution and the aftermath of that and dystopian presentations thereof. You know, I was listening to one of the horror movie podcasts that I listened to a couple of weeks back, and they were talking about Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive film, which had the soundtrack is all AC/DC songs. And they were talking about how AC/DC are masters of the single entendre, that all their songs and song lyrics consist of some pretty thinly veiled sexual innuendo. Which, you know, I thought that's a bit unfair, because that's what a double entendre is, right? And something like, she was a fast machine, she kept her murder clean, or even let me cut your cake with my knife is a double entendre, right? But then I realized things like You Shook Me All Night Long and Let Me Put My Love Into You really aren't. So that is to say, much like Brian Johnson and I guess the rest of AC/DC as well, Egyptian science fiction writers seem to be masters of the single entendre, right, when they're writing these books. But also, in the period that we're getting these translations from is rather limited. These are all books from in and around the Egyptian revolution, so it's unsurprising that they would all be focused on that. Maybe we would get a bit more variation if a wider sample size was available to me. So far, it is not. But yeah, I am very interested, having gone through all this to check out, yeah, at least Sharif and Muhammad's works, and possibly Tawfiq's paranormal series as well, to see how mummies and things are treated by an Egyptian author, whether they are just rehashes of Western tropes or whether they bring their own spin to things. But I think even going back through those examples, I mean, apart from the paranormal, I'm looking more at the literary utopian ones, is certainly evidence for Campbell's double or half estrangement thing, which the more I think about it, the more I say it's like, maybe that's just what utopian literature is. Utopian literature is a semi-removed satirical commentary on the current government, right? I've sort of landed at the point where, yeah, like I said at the start, Egyptian literature certainly does this, but I think, yeah, this is true not only of Egyptian literature, but all utopian and dystopian literature. Though, again, looking at these examples, which I realize I have a limited sample set here, but just with what I have before me, it doesn't seem like these Egyptian writers have gone much beyond this half-estranged utopian concept of science fiction. They haven't really got into the really extrapolative, inventive stuff that we see from numerously post-World War II English and American science fiction, like in the second half of the 20th century and beyond. But maybe that is because they have more pressing concerns to deal with, and I'm sure there are many, including the juries of these various literary awards and things, that would argue that something commenting about the fallout from a revolution is perhaps more pressing than trippy new wave space stories and things. So all that is to say, to bring this back to the supposed subject of the podcast itself, is it seems like Pratchett was pretty on the money with pyramids, right? I don't think he was thinking about these sorts of things. I'm not trying to make the argument that he had some kind of deliberate and well-researched insight into Egyptian politics and its literary culture and history and things. I think he was just playing off the largely Western colonial archetypes that I talked about in the previous episode, but that doesn't change the fact that where we end up in pyramids as a story about, you know, the seemingly unchanging, stifled Egyptian society that is kept down by a systematically oppressive government that is holding back both its technological and social progress, and is specifically doing so by installing new governments that are hardly removed from the old governments. And it was not only evidence within the society itself, but is a recurring and dominant theme throughout Egyptian examples of science fiction, if not specifically fantasy literature. I mean, the fantasy examples that I have being these supernatural series, you know, don't suggest too much political commentary or insight to them. And also to tie it into pyramids somewhat is we also have the fact that these science fictional, and in this case also the fantasy stuff as well, these genres that are able to speak against and challenge the prevailing Egyptian order somewhat are intimately tied up with influences from outside and distinctly English and American science fiction traditions. Where I still differ from and am somewhat critical of Pratchett is that, you know, I don't think this is a technological thing where they're wasting state resources building pyramids and things. Like, despite the gestures to the warring factions of the surrounding states, we don't actually get any engagement with the Jellybabian military in pyramids, right? It's not through military force that Deos is able to keep his hold on the Egyptian government and society, right? It's more just through tradition, which might be just me overreading things and looking into things deeper than certainly Pratchett ever intended me to, and that perhaps I should. But I also think it is very interesting that almost 10 years later, we get a heavily military-focused portrayal and engagement with many of these same ideas and themes, or rather their inversion within an appearing country rather than a disappearing one, in Jingo, which is also talking or engaging with specifically Middle Eastern and Arabic cultures and things. You know, even before the September 11th attacks and the war on terror and things like that, Jingo was published in 1997, so I'm not really sure what the shift and impetus is there, possibly the fallout from the first Gulf Wars, but yeah, I'll get into that when I get to that book, which is probably literally in actually like 5 or 6 years. But yeah, I don't mean at all to suggest that these are the kind of things that Pratchett was intending to provoke with pyramids, but the fact is we have an example of at least one reader of his work, being myself, who was inspired to think about all these things and go looking into and investigating Egyptian politics and science fiction because of them. But if it can happen to me, perhaps it can happen to someone else. And if it does, this podcast will be there to hopefully facilitate a further investigation into these sorts of things, rather than being left to flounder on their lonesome as I have.
All right, that is it for now, and probably, hopefully, it for Egyptian fantasy and science fiction things, for no other reason than that I do seem to have exhausted the resources available to me at the moment. I mean, on the Wikipedia page for the Egyptian Society for Science Fiction, which is what I should have been calling it this entire episode instead of the Egyptian Science Fiction Association. I think I got it mixed up with the just the General Science Fiction Research Association there. I'm sure I mispronounced so many things in this episode, so I'm very sorry to everyone whose name I said incorrectly. But yeah, on the Wikipedia page for the Egyptian Society for Science Fiction, which does seem to have been written by Elsenbehi himself. It gives like minute details of every single conference paper he's ever given and things, and again seems to be more dedicated towards talking up himself than actually giving much information or accessibility to Egyptian science fiction. But it does say on there that he's currently working on translations of his three novels that I talked about, and that also the collections that the society have put out, some of those contain like a few translations of some short stories and things in there, but I cannot find any record or, you know, way to access this stuff at the moment. I mean, what the Wikipedia page doesn't contain is any link or contact information for the society itself, and I haven't been able to find any outside of that either. But yeah, I think I've probably hit the limit for what was essentially a curious aside that, yes, I promise wouldn't take over my life the way vampires did. So yes, while I will probably keep an eye on and, you know, look into any new Egyptian translations and things that come out, I won't subject you guys to that, you know, unless I find someone who says, you know, specifically Science Pratchett or something like that. What I will subject you to is some upcoming analysis on Small Gods. I have, I think, largely finished the research for those episodes, and I've got some rough outlines from what at the moment at least is looking like. It's going to be two smaller episodes on that book, but you will be happy to hear that I think perhaps even more so than any of the other episodes I've done so far, these are really, from what I've got so far, focused in on talking about Small Gods itself. Yes, I won't be going into the history of the Bible and how it's written, all of that. At least I say I won't. I'm trying really hard to stop myself. I think that would be a pretty exhausting rabbit hole to go down. So yeah, hopefully I can avoid falling in that. I'm going to call it a pothole. But those episodes are probably still at least a month away. You know, it's still taking a long time between these, but I seem to have hit a semi-regular rhythm in terms of releasing them at least. So I'm going to try and keep that up. And yeah, I'll be back when I can. But whenever that is, I won't see you then. Bye!
And we're clear.
You know, just as a quick aside, I did go looking for Egyptian death metal bands just in parallel to what I'm doing here. And yeah, shockingly, there's not that many, which you do get stories more in Southeast Asia and the Middle East than Egypt, of metal bands being outlawed and persecuted by government. So I'm really not surprised that the Egyptian metal scene is not flourishing over there. I mean, there are, the obvious example is Nile, who are an Egyptian themed band rather than Egyptian band. They're from the US, but yes, their music is Egyptian and Egyptian fantasy themed in terms of its lyrics, but also the instrumentation relies a lot on Phrygian modes and things that we associate with Middle Eastern music. But yeah, they're not actually Egyptian. And yeah, looking for actual examples of Egyptian extreme music, there aren't that many, and the ones that aren't particularly relevant. I mean, there's a guy, Nada Sadak, who's done some pretty cool work, but mostly with musicians from other countries and in the UK, and is mostly known for his visual work with the Norwegian band Mayhem, so not distinctly Egyptian there. There's some other bands, I think Scarab is probably the most notable one, but yeah, not a flourishing extreme music scene in Egypt, and according to Tufik, it will all be eclipsed by this more extreme and orgasmic counterpart in a few years anyway. That last section was a mess.